The Bane Free Radio Hour.
Welcome everyone to another episode. I'm your host, Jeremy Como. That is enough about me. If you click on the video, you're here to talk about my guest today, Mr. Richard Fox. Welcome, Richard. Thanks for coming on.
Well, always a pleasure to be here.
All right. Appreciate it. Well, I was saying before, last time we spoke, it was you and David Weber. This is the first time I actually get to speak to you on your own. And so we're going to take this time to get to know you a little bit better. But before we do, I'll do a little quick intro. So Richard Fox is a Dragon Award winner for Best Military Sci-Fi and Fiction Fantasy Novel. He's best known for his Ember War Saga and military science fiction and space opera series. His writing draws extensively from his experiences in the United States Army, where he served two combat tours in Iraq and was awarded the Bronze Star, Combat Action Badge, and Presidential Unit Citation. And so welcome. Appreciate you coming on. So let's talk about what we came to talk about, and that's Men of Britain. I thoroughly enjoyed the book. This was a fun read. It was a fast, fun read, and lots of action. But you also made me laugh a little bit. towards the end.
Okay, good.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I don't want to spoil it for everybody, but there's laugh towards the back there.
Yeah, yeah. I can tell you had fun writing the book because I had fun reading it. So let's get into it. The name. Let's start with the title of the book. Where does Men of Britain come from?
Well, Britain is the name of the planet where the majority of the characters are drawn from. Mm-hmm. And actually, they're all men who are essentially drafted to go and fight for the hegemony, and which was the larger galactic sort of nation that the Breton is part of. And when they finally get to their first duty assignment, they're thrown straight into the fight, and things just get worse from there for them. So the whole series deals with how the men of Breton go from, you know, being thrown into the middle of a civil war to being part of a much larger civil war, all the while they're just trying to get home. So that's what Men of Britain is about a group of soldiers who are just doing everything they can to get home. I pitched it as Hammer Slammers meets the Odyssey. And there is indeed a tank that comes up later in the story with a really interesting character attached to it. So, that's what Men of Britain is. It draws on kind of my background, because during my very first tour in Iraq, I was started off in 2003, which was a long time ago. And when we first got there, I was right behind my unit, 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment, was behind 3rd ID and the Marines who had driven up to Baghdad. And we didn't know how long we were going to be there. We didn't know how long the war was supposed to last. I was in Kuwait and went into the mess tent, and they had a TV screen up, and there was George Bush standing on top of standing on an aircraft carrier with the words "Mission Accomplished" and a big banner behind him. And I was like, "Damn it! There's nothing for me to do. We'll be home in 2 weeks." And incorrect, incorrect, as we found out pretty quick. There was no. We thought that there would be a magical Iraqi government to stand up and take over everything, and that didn't happen. And we thought the Iraqis would be so happy to see us because we got rid of Saddam, and that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And then we thought, oh, we'll be home in a year, and that didn't happen either. But what happened towards the end of the year? My unit had we handed over authority for our mission to another unit, and we had all the vehicles lined up. We're going to drive back to Kuwait, load up the vehicles, go home after a year, and then this guy named Muqtada al-Sadr caused a revolt throughout central Iraq. And they told my unit, "Hey, you're not going home, but you are driving south. We need you to make some stops along the way and take these cities back from this revolt that had happened." Mm-hmm. And so my 2 to 3 month initial thought of a deployment turned into 15 months of a deployment. So just, you know, kind of what men in Breton go through is kind of what my unit went through during that whole extension of, we're almost home, we're going home, and oh no, we are not going home, and things have just gotten way worse.
Yeah, some new suck comes along.
yeah, it never seemed to end. But so, you know, my unit, we eventually did get home after 15 months, and it was, that was a little surreal coming back after all that.
So talking about that, the one funny part towards the end, which we'll not discuss, was there any direct experience that?
No.
Or you just having fun?
You know, I was just having, it was when I was outlining the book, that just for whatever reason, the characters weren't meshing the way I would have liked them to. Mm-hmm. And then for some reason, you know, the muse came over and just said, shower scene. And I'm like, hold on. Now I can make this work. And all of a sudden, just, you know, everything that goes around that one scene suddenly made the whole rest of the book work, which is a little weird. And you think about it, but, you know, like, oh, Men of Breton, did you get to the shower scene yet? I think people are going to be like, what kind of book is this? Mm-hmm. You know, boy, that sounds awful, but it's not that kind of a book. I think I just watched way too much Friends growing up. Mm-hmm. And then, like, you know, I thought, okay, that scene could have worked in Friends. Mm-hmm. Just the reaction. So, or It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia could have worked too, but
yeah. So after the incident, I loved all the shit talking. Mm-hmm. that came with it. This book is for everybody. But it's like, if you're a guy and you've had, guy friends and you did something stupid, you're going to get you'll get a chuckle anyway, but you'll get a chuckle out of it. You know, if you've ever done anything stupid.
Yeah.
And somebody caught you.
And it's the same way in the military where if you do something stupid, people are going to let you know you did something stupid and you're going to have to, you know, eat that crow for possibly forever. But, you know, it's in the Navy. I mean, if you're a pilot and you screw up, you get a whole new call sign. There's a lot of, you know, okay. So I was a young lieutenant during my first tour. I was a little more seasoned captain during my second tour. But, you know, it's a lot of the interactions within the story between all the soldiers is drawn from all my time in the Army. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of things that, you know, I think people who've been in the military will read that one part like, oh, yeah, I know exactly where he's going with this. Or, you know, they can relate to some of the things that had happened.
And I wasn't in the military, but I had this book was fun. It was tons of action. For our characters, and it was fun. A lot of the terms you use, the shit talking and all that, just made it a fun book.
My 6 year old stopped by to say hi, but
he's blurry.
Yep, I'm glad you had a fun time reading it. It was fun to write. I mean, there's still some of the, you know, some more harder parts,
of course,
to get through.
Yes.
But you know, it's, and there's a short story up on Bain right now called Datarod I-37, mm-hmm. which kind of gives a little bit more background into what was going on with the hegemony. Mm-hmm. And so if you're on Bain, I encourage you to give that short story a read. It was fun. That one was fun to write too. Is the setup is a little different, but I think it'll make sense to everybody who, you know, watches people on YouTube and videos perhaps. So.
Exactly. So for the uninitiated, let's talk about the world. Let's where is this set? Let's talk about the hegemony and kind of go from there.
Sure. The hegemony, when I originally this universe first came out in a book called Hell's Horizon, which I co-wrote with Jonathan Bazee. And that book is set about 20-25 years before Men of Breton. It's mm-hmm. not required reading at all, but it's nice to read too. Mm-hmm. As you get a little bit more, you know, kind of the background. And when I first saw the hegemony, my thought was, okay, this is going to be Yugoslavia. Mm. And so long as there was, you know, a powerful force holding Yugoslavia together, Yugoslavia was okay. But when the Soviet Union collapsed, all of a sudden, Yugoslavia wasn't anymore. And then you had all these, you know, really it's more centuries of animosity was allowed to come back into the fore. So that's what I had with the idea with the hegemony, is that this was a nation state that was held together with string and duct tape. And when the center fell out, the whole thing is just, it was going to collapse into fire. So we see the first beginnings of that. I mean, if you read Hell's Horizon or you look at Datarod or I-37, you see it's like, oh, hey, the hegemony was never that legitimate and was never that strong. And the collapse was, pretty certain to happen. Mm-hmm. But when it did happen, it caught everyone by surprise. Mm-hmm. You know, like when the Soviet Union fell, I think, back in the 80s and 70s, you could say the Soviet Union is going to, collapse for these following reasons. And then when it gets to the 90s, it's like, oh, well, that it surprised everyone, especially the Soviets, when it collapsed. So that's the way the hegemony is. It was a corrupt system that was never going to last. And when it collapsed, it happened to everyone's surprise. And then it just gets worse from there.
Yeah, it's just a house of cards. Yeah. No, I can definitely see the parallels now that you say it. With that, is this its own fictional universe, or is this far, far in the future? Or
I think I've got it down as in the year 2500. There, so it's in the future. It's not connected to anything else I've written except for Hell's Horizon. Other than that, it's its own thing.
Okay, well, let's talk about the characters then, because you do a good job of making me want to care about these characters, and I like the fact. Let me let you talk about it, and I'll tell you what I like.
Sure. I think the first character everyone's going to come across is named Felix. Mm-hmm. And Felix isn't from Breton. Felix ends up kind of this outsider character who's always, he's with the main characters from Breton. And then he kind of gets kind of pulled along with them along their journey. And he was fun because, well, not fun, but boy, he didn't have a good time at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And it just gets worse and worse and worse for him until he finally comes across the rest of the characters from Breton, and then he's just so thankful that he's actually people finally around people who aren't gonna shoot him and eat him sort of situation.
Mm-hmm.
But he had he's one of my more favorite characters just because he's outside of everyone's purview, and he is his own guy, and he has his own kind of culture that he comes from, and so he's very different from everyone else. And then and one group of characters who they're just barely in this book, and that's the Antares.
Mm-hmm.
They're a religious order who never speak to anyone. But the Antares, they're out there to find soldiers who have been lost on the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
And they never speak to anyone. And that way they're always seen as neutral because they don't give anyone any help. They just show up and, they just try to find, soldiers who have been lost. Mm-hmm. And we get just a little bit of them in this book, but in future books, they become very important for one certain character. I don't want to get into it, but the Antares came from, I love Sabaton. I don't know if you ever listened to Sabaton. Mm-hmm. For everyone at home, Sabaton is, I'm not making this up, Swedish military history metal. Okay, if you look them up, they're just the best. They're a great band. They sing about, World War II and all these other conflicts. And they had a song called Soldier of Heaven, which is a really great song. You can find the video. And it's about a soldier who's, so determined to do his duty that his soul doesn't leave Earth. He remains a ghost to continue doing his duty. And I'm like, oh my God, that's horrible. I'm like, this guy needs to move on. And so that's kind of what the Antares are there for. They're there to find spirits and help them move on. So, like, I, you know, it's So it kind of, they came, you know, had the idea from a Sabaton song, and it's just slowly kind of working its way into this series. And then, you know, we have all the main characters from Breton, and they're part of a larger battalion that kind of gets, you know, condensed down as time goes on for casualties. And Breton is largely modeled off of Breton and Normandy or West Northwest France. And the Bretons do not consider themselves French a lot of the times, even though they speak mostly French, but you know, that's French for you. Like we're inside French, but they're determined to be French, but we're not that kind of French. We're our own.
So, we're not that French. Yeah.
So they have their own, you know, society and culture. That's a little different because from Breton, they prioritize actual labor instead of just having robots and machines do everything. Mm-hmm. So like if somebody's a baker, he actually does the baking. If someone's a farmer, they do as much manual labor as possible because they think that keeps them more centered in life. So they're not going to be the most technologically, you know, adept people in this setting, but all of a sudden it's like, oh, we got to fix it. Oh, they know how to fix it. So they're going to be a little bit more adept in some aspects. And there's a pair of brothers who are in the book, an older sergeant, mm-hmm. One character who has a more checkered background. And then later on we get a skein character. The skeins are a sort of a genetically designed group that have all the moral and ethical constraints that they're given. And if they're not given too many, they just don't have them. Mm-hmm. And they don't have the same sort of socialization or even, ability to interact with people that most other normal people in this setting would have. So we have a skein character who comes on later on, and she's going to have a much more difficult time as the series goes on. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, if you've ever seen like, you know, the more classic war movies, you see a lot of like kind of archetypes and tropes, mm-hmm. and they're all in here. I think it works pretty well for this sort of a story. It's military sci-fi, you know, in a civil war environment. So you could make all the Vietnam parallels mm-hmm. that you want there. And then we have the more senior leadership characters. There's Lambert, who is he was never meant to be a commander. Mm-hmm. He got his rank because he's the governor of Breton's cousin, and he actually is pretty good with numbers. So they said, okay, look, you're going to be in the reserves. You're not really in the military, but we need to bring you along just to do all the books. And Lambert, he's not meant to command, but he's going to be put into a number of situations where he has to shine. And then there's a Major Perrin who shouldn't be in command, doesn't quite have the right mentality for it, but has to, you know, learn to grow and actually take over the situation after everything just goes straight to crap. So all the characters in this book get challenged pretty early and pretty difficultly, or difficult, that's not a word, but you know, they're all challenged with the situation that they get put into.
Yeah. No. Cause it seems as soon, like you said, the suck continues, man. It's just beating after beating.
And the beatings continue until morale improves.
Exactly. Exactly. So, one thing, I like, cause I'm the youngest twin son out of six boys.
Okay.
And I like the fact that, because I know, you know, in the military, your brother is the guy next to you, and you know, you're fighting for him as much as yourself and everything. But to actually have siblings in the same unit, have you ever come across that?
That is, it's rare, and it's intentional that you don't want siblings in the same unit, because there's who's your brother going to listen to more, his own brother or his sergeant? So there's command and control issues, and then God forbid there's a tragedy, it just gets worse.
Yeah.
And you know, the Navy had the Sullivans, I believe it was, mm-hmm. had like four brothers on one ship, and what happens when that ship sinks? Okay,
whole family goes down.
Yeah, yeah. And then if you've seen Saving Private Ryan, you know how that mm-hmm. the beginning goes after that, after the scene on Normandy Beach.
Yes.
So
that's it. Talk about heavy movies.
yeah. You would sometimes see a brother, sister, or sometimes even father, son in reserve units. You would see that sometimes.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine, because it's bad enough, you know, watching your friends get hurt and everything. I couldn't imagine being fighting alongside and just feel like I have to protect that one person specifically, you know.
Yep. Yeah.
But it got me though. I was like, oh man. And so it made me much more interested in their relationship and the fact that, you know, if one got hurt or one or the other got hurt and you know, how they would take it and all that stuff. So it was very interesting, and it caught me just from having so many brothers. Now let's kind of talk about the opposition. Who are the bad guys per se?
Right. Initially the antagonists, they're just referred to as the Flags, and they are the local people of the planet, which Dalaran, and they have a really legitimate cause for fighting for independence. Because as you read the book and you kind of realize, oh, the hegemony has done some rather awful things to the locals. And so you see, like, hey, you know, you understand where the enemy is kind of coming from. And then you also look at, you know, the men of Breton, they get thrown into the situation and they don't have any real animosity towards the locals, and the locals just see them as, well, they're dressed like everyone else we've been fighting. So it's, you know, that's one kind of thing about war, is that you could not have any kind of personal beef at all with the people you end up fighting. They don't have one with you, but you've got a weapon and you're dressed in a different uniform, so we have to kill each other now. And that's some weird human logic that happens during conflict. Is it like, well, he wasn't dressed like me and he had a gun. And like, and everyone in the military is like, yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that math checks out.
Yeah, yeah. And so we don't. So we kind of just. So the rebels or the insurgents, they're more kind of like a force of nature in this book. We don't get to see, you know, come down to any of their characters, but rather you understand what their situation is, why they're fighting, and then you also see that they're pretty good at fighting, The hegemony was in the last stages of losing the planet when things go from worse to even worse.
When you're reading this book, just from my point of view, when you're reading this book, your heart rate's going to be up most of the book.
Yeah,
most of the book. Then you get a little chuckle and then we're back in the shit. Do you want to talk about any like specific technology or anything like that that you incorporated in the book?
Well, sure. For this book, there's a lot of use of not so much mechs, but as wearable armor. That it's not as complex as the armor that's in like my other series, like the Ember War, but rather it's for the hegemony when they fight their infantry, they have two main modes. You have the flankers, who wear essentially it's just an exosuit that, you know, goes along the arms and legs and backs, and it just helps with strength and moving faster. It's meant to aid movement. And then you had the strikers, who were wearing, you know, full up armor. You step into the suit, and then they all have, like, you know, the larger caliber weapons, and like the whatever arm is forward, it has more armor on it, so they end up getting referred to as crabs because it looks like they have one big crab arm. And so that's, and then we have, then there's tanks, lots of tanks, and we'll get to know one kind of tank pretty well. And we'll stay with that one tank for quite a while. But then as for technology wise, there's not AI doing everything. And there's still a focus on, you know, soldiers, you know, out there fighting other soldiers. But there are some drones to it, but you know, there's ways to mitigate that. And then if you lose your drone coverage, you're pretty much done. So we haven't got much into the space combat, but there is one little twist on space combat, which I was kind of happy with. I think that kind of that should surprise some readers towards the end of the book. There is, you know, what one ship does to defeat another one. Mm-hmm. Just leave it there. But
yeah. No, it's good, folks. It's good. I enjoyed it. I did enjoy the character that comes with the tank.
Not so much.
I did enjoy it. It's just a different type of person, you know. Mm-hmm. But it was entertaining. But you did a good job of making me interested in that character and care about that character pretty quickly, even though they come in towards the end of the book. Mm-hmm.
And now we bring you our audiobook serialization of Tinker by Wynn Spencer. Inventor girl genius Tinker lives in a near future Pittsburgh, which now exists mostly in the land of the elves. She runs her salvage business, pays her taxes, and tries to keep the local ambient level of magic down with gadgets of her own design. When a pack of wargs chase an elven noble into her scrapyard, life as she knows it takes a serious detour. Tinker finds herself taking on the Elven Court, the NSA, the Elven Interdimensional Agency, technology smugglers, and a college-minded xenobiologist as she tries to stay focused on what's really important, her first date. Armed with an intelligence the size of a planet, steel-toed boots, and a junkyard dog attitude, Tinker is ready to kick butt to get her first kiss.
10 days. Tinker was growing frightened that she wasn't going to make the deadline. True, the carpentry finished the first week, and the carpenters moved to the second gate to leisurely work there. After a week of hammering, the silence had seemed a blessing. But now the quiet seemed only to make the approaching deadline more ominous. She hadn't counted on the fact that the Oni had no electricians, and that those Oni working with her were so unfamiliar with electricity that they were clueless. What could be so hard about running cables? She thought monkeys could do it. She had been interrupted time and time again to check their work. Wiring out of phase, miswiring the grounds, hooking the grounds in sequence into the main 240 line. The Oni didn't miss a single way to screw up something so simple. More than once, she had them rip several hours of work out. At least the confusion allowed her to slip in modifications unnoticed by Riki or Chiyo. Speaking of the Kitsune, she was going to kill Chiyo soon. After a battle of spiders, which she won with the steel spinner incident, snakes began to infest her thoughts. Unfortunately, all the bits of cable littering the warehouse lent themselves to Chiyo's illusions. The Kitsune apparently couldn't find room in Tinker's head while she was locked on circuit design, but the moment she was called away, she'd find the nearest cable suddenly slithering around. Annoying as it was, Tinker was more frightened that Chiyo would report Tinker's concerns of missing the deadline. Only 10 days remained. She had carefully reshaped the original gate's specs so that her gate opened a dimensional door only within its limits. She was still struggling with compressing the design down to the 100-to-1 ratio. There was still the masking, dipping, fitting. The list went on and on. And that assumed everything worked the first time. In danger of losing track of details, she'd sacrificed an hour to creating a schedule, copied it to her datapad, and printed up a copy for the wall. She found herself, however, now glancing at the schedule instead of the clock. 10 heavily loaded days. "Stay focused," she murmured, and jumped slightly as Pony set a bowl down in front of her. "Forgiveness." "Oh, it's just Chiyo with her damn snakes and prying thoughts keeping me on edge on top of everything else. Rice and fish again? Blah." Pony grunted slightly. She looked up and noticed that he was focused across the warehouse. A patrolling Oni warrior had come into the warehouse, strolling around the massive wooden ring. "A new one?" she asked, returning to her food and diagrams. Non-workers wanting to see the imposing gate were an annoyance she suffered for Pony's sake. He used the opportunity to track the Oni's numbers. 61, Pony whispered. "Small, rifle and sword, no pistol." Tinker winced at the number, which climbed daily. Already the Oni warriors outnumbered Windwolf's Sakasha 3-1. Pony was of the opinion, though, that the Oni weren't as skilled fighters. The ones in charge are always the biggest and loudest. They run toward fat, and I haven't seen any sign of weapon practice. Riki came up, checking things off his datapad.
I think we finally nailed down the wiring. How's the circuit coming?
I'm just finishing, I think. I want to run them through a simulator before committing them to tile. Riki nodded to the wisdom of this. Tinker sensed Pony tensing, which probably meant Chiyo was closing on them. She spared a glance to check. The kitsune had paused, standing in profile to them to talk to one of the Oni doing the wiring. Already the kitsune looked like she had a small pumpkin under her kimono. Riki had mentioned that a kitsune gestation was only 50 days. At 10 days, she was nearly the equivalent of 3 months in human pregnancy. I can't let the Oni into my world, Tinker thought for the 1,000th time, and then firmly locked away her thoughts. What is your plan? Do you have an army sitting on the other side of this gate?
Yes,
Riki said. It started to amass last year, Chiyo joined the conversation. I'm told it numbers in the tens of thousands. This gate is only good while Pittsburgh is on Elfholm, Tinker pointed out. Even if you wait until after shutdown to start bringing over your army, to maximize your time before the humans can react, you only have 28 days until the next shutdown. Then Pittsburgh goes back to Earth, either fully loaded with Oni or a war-torn ghost town. What little I know of the United States, they usually don't take kindly to that kind of shit.
We'll ride the shutdown out,
Riki said, unconsciously echoing Oil Can's phrase.
And after that, there won't be another shutdown.
What? Tinker yelped. How can you stop shutdown?
Shutdown is just flipping a switch,
Riki said. Chiyo laughed. Oh, stupid fake elf. If we had the station built, don't you think we can control when it turns on and off? The Oni are working with the Chinese? Somehow Tinker thought the Oni had merely been feeding the Chinese information. But even as she said it, she realized that the cooperation would have to go deeper than that.
I told you that some of us were stranded on Earth for hundreds of years,
Riki said quietly.
Many of the kitsune's mental powers, like the mind reading, do not need magic to work. They have infiltrated the Chinese government to the highest levels. They're the ones that pushed through the building of the gate.
Tinker frowned. The gate was wholly an Oni's project? What about the colony at Alpha Centauri?
There is no colony, Riki said. It's an elaborate sham that the Tengu and the Kitsune dreamed up. The gate is nothing more than a huge magician's box that we pull rabbits out of.
The problem with liars was knowing when they were telling the truth. Tinker couldn't believe that the entire 20-year colonization program had been a sham. Where the hell are the colony ships going?
Don't know, Riki shrugged. We were hoping that they would go to Elfholm, or, failing that, Onihida, but they didn't go to either. We don't know what star system your father calibrated the gate for, so we picked one for the media. As far as we know, the ships could be on the other side of the galaxy, or a fourth dimension of Earth. Wherever they are, they've got a lot of empty cargo pods. We had to keep pushing stuff through the gate to justify leaving it on.
They've been without supplies for 20 years? Tinker stared at him, stunned. Lane and the astronomers had filled her life with information on the colonists until they were intimate strangers. How could you do that?
We don't even know if they've survived the jump. If they came out next to a black hole or any exotic star system, like a red nova or white dwarf, all the supplies in the world couldn't keep them alive.
But all the progress reports from the colony?
We didn't have to worry about reports immediately, as Alpha Centauri is light years away. Eventually, we put up a satellite in an extreme orbit with correctors to fake a signal from the colony. Beijing beams the feed up to the satellite that bounces it back in a wide enough spread that you can pick it up anywhere on Earth.
She noticed Chiyo's gaze fixated on her, like a hunter seeing prey, and concentrated on factoring numbers. Stay out of my mind, you little bitch. Riki picked up the dirty dishes and handed them to the kitsune.
Make yourself useful.
They watched Chiyo carry the plates away.
If it makes you feel any better, all the first colonists were Tengu and Kitsune. They knew the risks, and we did send supplies for the first few years. They were our family. But Tom Tom decided it was a waste of food and goods. He diverted the cargo to Onihira, where starvation is common.
There's been ships full of people every 5 years since then. Riki nodded, bleak.
Yes, there have.
That was another installment in Wynn Spencer's Tinker, and that's it for the podcast. Thanks as always to Audible.com and podcast theme composer Ruth Judkowitz, and good night, Tony Daniel, wherever you are. This is David F. Shirod coming to you from a soundproof bunker somewhere deep in the heart of Texas. Join us here next week in the hammering heart of science fiction and fantasy, and keep reaching for the stars.